Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Kate, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Living with Advanced Skin Cancer. And today's program, which is part one of this three-part series, is New Perspectives in the Treatment of Advanced Skin Cancer, and it's going to focus on basal cell and squamous cell cancers. Today's program is a collaborative effort between many other cancer organizations, and it's because of that collaboration we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. Now, we have over 649 participants on the call today, so there's many of you on the call today from all of the United States, from all different regions of the United States, and we also have international participants from Australia, Canada, and the United Kingdom, so you really come from all over the world. I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials is information about our speakers, about the topics that they'll be addressing, as well as an evaluation form. And I would ask you to take a moment at the end of today's program and complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, you are the best people to tell us the programs that we should be offering going forward. And we are planning many programs for this year, and so your suggestions are very timely and important to us. And indeed, this particular series is one that many of you had asked us to offer, and so here it is, and we try very hard to offer the programs that you request. Today's program was made possible by Bristol-Myers Squibb, Genentech, a member of the Roche Group, Novartis Oncology, and an independent educational grant from Merck & Company, Inc., and we really want to thank them for their support of this program and this entire series, and indeed for their collaborative partnership in making this program possible. That corporate support is really very important as a collaborative group. Now, we have wonderful speakers today on our program, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Alan Ho. And Dr. Ho is medical oncologist, Department of Medicine, Head and Neck Oncology Service, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And Dr. Ho is going to address an overview of advanced skin cancer, including advanced basal cell cancers and advanced squamous cell cancers. He's going to present the standard of care, new treatment approaches, the emerging role of targeted therapy, clinical trial updates, and managing treatment side effects as well. And I'm going to now turn this program over to Dr. Ho.
Yeah, thank you so much for the opportunity to address everybody on this call today. So I will be addressing the management of advanced skin cancer, but more even more specifically about the potential role that chemotherapy or drug therapy plays in the management of this disease. I'm a medical oncologist, and that is the role that I usually play in the management of these diseases. So just to kind of give you a brief outline of what I'll be discussing the systemic drugs or chemotherapy agents we usually use in the standard of care for these diseases. We'll be speaking about one of the newly approved agents or drugs for the management of basal cell cancers that really serves now as a model for how we're going to move forward with trying to identify new agents both for basal cell cancers and for squamous cell cancers. We'll talk a little bit about how clinical trials generally work and when they may or may not be appropriate for the management of diseases. And then as a segue into all of those things, Dr. Lacouture is an international expert on the management of side effects of these agents, and he'll be speaking more, be kind of jumping off that and speaking more about how to manage those things. And so before I even begin, I think the topic does require even just defining what advanced skin cancers are. As all of you, I'm sure, are aware, cutaneous or skin malignancies are the most common type of cancers encountered. The flip side of that is in the overwhelming majority of time, simply resecting them or taking them off usually is a curative type of approach. When I think of advanced skin cancers, I'm often thinking about these same cancers in the more rare situations where they may spread to a lymph node or spread to a different organ, or when those cancers specifically can't be addressed with local interventions. And those local interventions are either topical medications, surgical resections, or the administration of radiation therapy. And the reason I break that up is because it's usually in those circumstances where chemotherapy is thought to play a potential role. So just to reemphasize, in disease that can be addressed with local interventions such as surgery, radiation, or topical medications, I usually favor those interventions for skin cancers first before considering systemic therapy. And the reason that's the paradigm I usually go by is because surgery and radiation and other topical medications for locally advanced skin cancers can be very effective. And chemotherapy, while it can generally be very effective for stabilizing or shrinking tumor growth, chemotherapy alone very rarely completely eliminates the disease. And so you have to be judicious about when those interventions are considered for patients. And so moving forward, I'm going to be referring to basal cell cancers as BCCs, just to avoid confusion, and then squamous cell cancers for SCCs, because even though both of these are cancers of the skin, they biologically, clinically, and therapeutically are very different. So having set up the paradigm for when chemotherapy usually is considered, I have to tell you that in most instances, this is not as much of a black and white issue. And the reason for that is, as I mentioned, in the vast majority of cases, the approaches to these malignancies are quite straightforward. You simply remove them or take them off, and the patients do well. So in situations where the skin cancers come back multiple times, are more advanced, where they're growing more rapidly, involving lymph nodes or involving other organs, this is a more rare situation. And even here at Memorial Sloan Kettering, where we deal in rare or more difficult type of diseases, this often requires a multidisciplinary kind of approach to the care of those patients, meaning that we always want to hear from the surgeons and the radiation oncologists, the dermatologists, and of course the medical oncologists, and come together, review these more difficult and rare cases, and come to some kind of conclusion about what the best approach might be. And sometimes that best approach requires a combination of all those different modalities. And certainly this has become more of an emphasis and point of emphasis for our own institution here as we seek to further advance potential therapies for advanced skin cancers. So I'm going to just speak to the chemotherapy part of it, understanding that in some situations, surgery and radiation also play very vital roles in the management of these patients. So in terms of standard of care for basal cell cancers and squamous cell cancers, BCCs and SCCs, the issue here is, again, these are rare diseases. And because they're rare diseases, we don't have a lot of clinical trial data that guides the way that we approach these tumors. As a basic principle, we have a whole litany of chemotherapy drugs, both old and new, which all work in different ways. And because they all work in different ways and attack cancer in different ways, they're not all applicable to different cancers the same way across the board. For instance, the agents that we use for lung cancers are different from the agents we use in breast cancers. And the way that we've traditionally tried to evaluate what drugs work in what situations is to do prospective clinical trials where we test these agents on a group of patients. We assess the clinical efficacy and based upon those results decide whether or not those should be standard of care for patients. In the instance of rare diseases, the numbers of patients are simply not large enough to sometimes do these trials, or the agents have not been available to be tested in these trials. And in those instances, we sometimes have to go by data generated from smaller reports or smaller studies. We have to go by institutional experiences for those studies, and sometimes we have to extrapolate from our experiences in other diseases that make sense. For instance, for squamous cell cancers, these cancers very much mimic under the microscope head and neck cancers, which are also squamous cell cancers, and head and neck cancers being the cancers of the mouth, throat, or voice box. And so the chemotherapies that we find can be effective for head and neck cancer, sometimes we extrapolate and apply for skin for SCCs of the skin, squamous cell cancers of the skin. So those agents are, you know, I'll briefly just touch upon, are sometimes called cisplatin, paclitaxel, and or 5 fluorouracil uracil. And there are some prospective trials, for instance, specifically in SCC, which have demonstrated some level of activity, for instance, with cisplatin. And based upon that small amount of data and extrapolation from other, from the head and neck literature, we can sometimes justify using that in our patients and have seen responses with those agents. Now, though that group of medicines are of this traditional older type of chemotherapy, which means that they, generally speaking, attack cancers by attacking the way that those cells divide or replicate their DNA. And so based upon that, they also have a very similar profile of side effects, including watching for how low your blood counts go. So we have to be worried about anemia and immune-fighting cells in those situations. And each of them also have their own specific side effects, which maybe Dr. Lockator will touch upon. So those are kind of the older style of chemotherapy. There is certainly benefit associated with them. They're non-experimental, meaning that often these agents are available to us outside of a clinical trial. And they certainly can historically and certainly present can be used for patients both with basal cell cancers and squamous cell cancers. But I think the revolution in cancer treatment to date has really been driven by the fact that we have now a better understanding of the biology of cancers, of the genetic changes that occur in cancers, and now the platforms and technology to better assess these gene mutations. And I think this evolution in the way that we understand cancers and the way we evaluate cancers and even categorize them is going to lead to some real-time changes in the way we treat these diseases in both the short and long term. And I think one of the case examples of this is in basal cell cancers. And so I'm just going to take a few minutes to talk about this. So basal cell cancers for a long time, advanced basal cell cancers that need chemotherapy, has been very difficult to treat because of the issues I raised before. It's a rare disease. There's very little known about what chemotherapies work. And generally speaking, I think the impression among the medical oncology community is that these diseases generally don't respond very well to traditional chemotherapy agents. Well, a few years ago, it was recognized that almost all of these cancers, if you look at their genetics, are driven by a specific pathway called the hedgehog pathway. And in these cancers, they have mutations in genes that lead to the activation or the superactivation of that pathway. Along the same time, there was a whole class of drugs that were developed to inhibit or drive down the activity of that pathway by inhibiting a gene called smoothened. And one of the great cancer therapeutic success stories over the last 5 years was the development of a drug called vismodegib, one of these smoothened inhibitors, for the treatment of advanced basal cell cancers. And what they found is you have a disease here where we identified a pathway and genetic changes that were driving the biology of that tumor, this hedgehog pathway. You had a class of drugs that could effectively inhibit and quiet that pathway. And when they did the clinical trials in basal cell cancer patients, they found that they had a good rate of response with that agent. And so all of that data put together led to the FDA approval of this agent a year and a half ago. And now we can write for and use vismodegib for the treatment of advanced basal cell cancers. So that kind of storyline where we took our understanding of cancer biology, the genes associated with it, and then also were able to apply the appropriate inhibitors in a very selective and almost personalized way for these diseases led to the identification of a new drug that was clinically active in a disease that was very difficult to treat with traditional chemotherapy. Now, the application of vismodegib, since the approval of vismodegib, one of the most common questions we get asked is what settings can we use it in? And we have to be very careful and judicious about this because, as I said before, the identification of this very active drug doesn't change the original paradigm, which is that in patients where disease is amenable to surgical resection or radiation, those modalities, those treatment approaches should be prioritized. And I still only use vismodegib when both surgery and radiation cannot be considered. There are ongoing trials to see how vismodegib could potentially affect basal cell cancers in different clinical settings, but the drug was specifically FDA approved in this setting for patients who couldn't have their disease addressed with either surgery or radiation. And the simple reason that is because as effective and great of a development as vismodegib has been, it's still not a curative therapy, meaning that it won't completely eliminate every cancer cell in your body if you've got advanced basal cell cancers. That's rather unlikely. And so most times patients will have to be maintained on these treatments to maintain the responses that they have. And so what's of critical importance, the other side of that, is making sure that this therapy is as manageable and sustainable for patients when it comes to side effect. And I think Dr. Lakator can kind of address some of those issues. Eventually, even basal cell cancer patients that respond to these drugs will often have their tumors grow through it as they find different ways to evade the anti-cancer properties of the drug. The good news is that you can still use this approach of better understanding diseases to try to develop new drugs, and that's an effort that's really ongoing. And what they found is that in a subset of these patients, the reason that they grow resistant to the drug is because you select out for a group of cancer cells within the tumor that have the smoothened target, which the drug can no longer bind and can no longer shut down the pathway. And it seems that one of the hypotheses moving forward is that maybe other drugs that inhibit that same target but in a slightly different way can then be developed and used after patients grow resistant to vismodegib. And that's a hypothesis that still is being tested and ongoing and look promising in the laboratory. So I think it's still this idea that with the first drug and the drug subsequent to that, that's the way that we're going to have to be developing these things, is really an understanding of the biology and understanding the gene alterations that occur. Now, for squamous cell cancers, we've had less movement in that area. And I think one of the reasons that we don't have as many new therapies for squamous cell cancers is because we don't have a good understanding of the biology yet that can drive the development of these clinical trials. And as part of that approach, what we're doing now here at Memorial and other centers are doing is trying to initiate research initiatives where we are taking patients' tumors who need systemic therapy and qualify for clinical trials, and trying to better understand the landscape of genetic changes in their tumors and seeing if that analysis would suggest a clinical trial that those patients should be on. There's no question that doing these genomic analyses and trying to find new therapies based upon that is a research approach. But it's a research approach that I think for a rare disease with limited treatment options is a good one to try to push the ball forward in terms of the research that's being done. I should mention that squamous cell cancers has, we also use a targeted agent or a new kind of therapy in squamous cell cancers called cetuximab, which is a trade name Erbitux. It's a drug that's used in colon cancer and in head and neck cancer, for instance. It's not been FDA approved for skin cancers, but there was a phase 2 trial demonstrating that in a small percentage of patients, you can get responses in patients with skin cancers. And that direction of targeting the protein that cetuximab targets called EGFR may be one that should be better, more looked at in clinical trials. And so I think moving forward, for both basal cell cancers and squamous cell cancers, clinical trials are still a very relevant option, even as the first treatment, because we are still really in our infancy as trying to understand what treatments may or may not work for these diseases. And the only way that this is going to be advanced is through the evaluation of patients on these studies. And the good news is that these studies also represent new and different approaches to a set of diseases that have traditionally been difficult to treat. So I think I'll just stop there at this point, and we can address, you know, more in detail what I've discussed or other subjects around this this matter during the question and answer time, so we don't take away time from Dr. Lakator or Anna Eckhart.
Thank you so much, Dr. Ho. That was really excellent and really set the stage and really reviewed a lot of the treatments for both advanced basal cell and advanced squamous cell cancer. So thank you so much. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. And our next speaker is Dr. Mario Lakator. And Dr. Lakator is Associate Attending Physician, Dermatology Service, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. Dr. Lakator is an internationally known dermatologist, and he is going to cover managing treatment side effects, discomfort and pain, tips for caring for your skin during cancer treatments, skin-sun safety tips, and guidelines for communicating with your healthcare team about quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Lakator.
Thank you very much, Caroline, and I would also like to thank everyone on today's call. I am a dermatologist at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, and I work very closely with Dr. Ho. And as we have heard over his presentation, there have been remarkable treatments in the past 5 or 10 years that have improved the management of advanced basal cell carcinomas and squamous cell carcinoma. However, along with those advances, a constellation of dermatologic and other side effects also appear very frequently every time that someone receives these treatments. Let's begin by the initial treatment of most skin cancers, which comprises surgery. With surgery, as we all know, the postoperative period can be complicated by infections of the surgical area, by pain in the surgical scar, or by abnormal or excessive formation of scar in the surgical site. Importantly, all of these complications can be managed effectively if brought to the attention of your doctor. For example, an infection can be treated with antibiotics, or when you have a scar from a skin cancer that has been treated, and if the scar is itchy or painful, or you just don't like the appearance of this scar, these scars, in many instances, can be treated by a plastic surgeon or a dermatologist. Secondly, Dr. Ho also mentioned that radiation is frequently used as part of the treatment of many skin cancers of the both types that we have discussed. Radiation frequently causes an inflammation or burning of the skin in the majority of patients, depending on the location of their skin cancers. It is important to note that there are creams, medicated creams, that contain anti-inflammatory properties that, if used preventively, are able to reduce the itching, the pain, and inflammation associated with radiation when it is used for the treatment of skin cancers. And also, this inflammation of the skin can also result in secondary infections of that skin, which are usually characterized by yellow crusting, pus, or pain in those areas, all of which can be treated effectively with the use of either topical, in other words, cream type of antibiotics, or antibiotics administered as pills or tablets. So therefore, it is very important that during your or following your surgical treatment and during your radiation treatment, if anyone experiences any of these complications, that they are brought to the attention of the surgeon, the radiation oncologist, or a dermatologist so that they can be adequately managed or ideally prevented. Secondly, Dr. Ho very clearly delineated the new types of drugs that have been approved for the treatment, especially of basal cell carcinomas. In this case, the drug bismodegib has been approved for the treatment of basal cell carcinomas that cannot be treated with surgery, radiation, or other therapies. Importantly, this drug is administered as a tablet daily, and it is associated with a group of side effects that has led to some people not being able to continue on the drug. Fortunately, however, most of these side effects can be managed appropriately. What are these side effects? The most common are muscle spasms or pain in the muscles. In some cases, these can be treated with oral anti-spasm medications or oral anti-pain medications prescribed by your oncologist. About two-thirds of people receiving bismodegib develop these muscle spasms. Please inform your doctor at any point at which you are experiencing side effects so that they can be adequately managed and you can continue receiving the drug. Other common side effects included loss of hair on the scalp and in the body with the use of bismodegib. This hair loss appears to be temporary and is usually not complete, but it's more of a hair thinning in all parts of the body. There may be ways to mitigate this with the use of topical minoxidil, for example, or the evaluation of a specialist in hair diseases, such as a dermatologist. Another common side effect that occurs in about half of people receiving bismodegib that we really don't have an effective treatment for is the fact that this side effect affects the way you feel, you taste food, or even you taste liquids. So people frequently report that food does not have an appealing taste and everything tastes like cardboard or tastes like metal. It is important to notify your doctor of this because this change in taste in your mouth can lead to loss of appetite, and indeed, about half of people receiving this bismodegib will report loss of weight that is significant. Other side effects include fatigue or being tired, as well as nausea or abnormal stomach sensation, as well as diarrhea. Please inform your doctor of these and any other side effects that may occur so that they can be treated effectively. Other drugs that Dr. Ho mentioned included conventional chemotherapeutic agents or treatments such as paclitaxel. Paclitaxel is a drug that has been around for a long time, and the most common side effects that occur with this drug are neuropathy, in other words, abnormal sensation in the fingertips and toe tips. It can be characterized by either a sensation of pins and needles or lack of sensation. This neuropathy can be prevented by holding ice packs during the infusion of Taxol. Also, it can be treated if there is the sensation of pins and needles with oral medications or tablets that dampen this increased sensitivity in the fingertips and toe tips. The nails can also be affected in about a third to half of people receiving paclitaxel or Taxol. This can also be prevented with the use of these ice packs in the hands and feet. And also, it is very important to see a dermatologist if you experience any nail changes that are either painful, cause separation of the nails from your fingertips, or also result in infections, which are usually identifiable by this foul-smelling fluid coming out from your fingertips. Another drug that Dr. Ho mentioned is fluorouracil. This is another drug or chemotherapeutic drug that has been around for a long time, and the most common side effects, other than general side effects such as feeling tired, in some cases nausea and vomiting, are that people frequently develop a rash, especially in areas of the body that have been exposed to the sun. This rash can be very itchy, but is easily treated with topical corticosteroid cream. Fluorouracil can also cause another skin problem that presents with the swelling and redness of the palms and soles. It is called hand-foot syndrome, and fortunately, with the use of very strong anti-inflammatory creams, we are able to treat this and prevent the pain so that people can continue with their daily activity. And finally, Dr. Ho also mentioned another drug that has been very promising in squamous cell carcinomas, known as cetuximab or Erbitux. This drug targets a specific protein in squamous cell carcinomas, but coincidentally, this protein is also very important for the normal functioning of your skin, your hair, and nails. So the majority of people receiving cetuximab or Erbitux will develop some dermatologic side effects, most notably an acne-like rash affecting the face and upper chest. The hair will become very curly and sparse. People can develop inflammation around the fingernails or toenails, and also the skin can become very dry and itchy. Therefore, anyone receiving cetuximab, I would recommend seeking an evaluation by a dermatologist that may aid you during your treatment to manage and ideally prevent any of these side effects with cetuximab, most notably the acneiform rash, which can be prevented with the use of a topical cream applied to the face and chest twice daily and taking an antibiotic tablet by mouth twice daily since the initiation of therapy. We have shown that we are able to reduce the appearance of this acne-like rash by using this topical cream and an oral antibiotic. And then, finally, it is also important to know that if you are a cancer survivor, especially from advanced skin cancers, it is important to avoid subsequent or additional skin cancers. And how do we do this? We do what we call sun protective behaviors. And these are consist of the following simple measures. Avoiding unprotected sun exposure during the hours of 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., using a broad-brimmed hat when going outside, applying a sunscreen with a sun protection factor of at least 30 every 2 hours or every hour if swimming or sweating. It is important to know that the reason most sunscreens do not work is because people do not apply enough of them. You need to apply about 1 ounce or the size of a golf ball every time you apply sunscreen, every 2 hours, as I said, or every hour. Also, please look in the back of the label of the sunscreen whenever you go to buy it to make sure that it says that it is a broad-spectrum sunscreen. In other words, it will protect you against all types of damaging ultraviolet rays coming from the sun. And then, finally, it is also important to use UV-protecting sunglasses and also to use protective clothing that has long sleeves or long shorts when going outside in the between the hours of 10 a.m. or 4 p.m. This may sound difficult, but there are many companies that have clothing that does have SPF or sun protection in them, and you can obtain these at many stores, or you can look at them online. In addition to that, there is a type of laundry detergent that has sun protection in it. So when you wash your clothes, you add this to the washing machine, and it renders your clothing sun-protective for your skin. So using the above-mentioned measures, along with the knowledge of the side effects that these anti-cancer agents can result in, may allow you to maintain your quality of life, prevent new skin cancers, and obtain the maximum benefits from the remarkable improvements in the treatment of advanced squamous cell carcinoma and basal cell carcinoma. Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much, Dr. LaCouture. That was really outstanding and just really very comprehensive. Thank you so much. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. And our next speaker is Ms. Anna Eckhart. Ms. Eckhart is an oncology social worker, and she is our coordinator of online services at Cancer Care. And she will be addressing the free Cancer Care psychosocial support services that we offer and the role of support groups. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Ms. Eckhart.
Thank you, Carolyn. Yes, I'm an oncology social worker, and I work with many patients and loved ones coping with and attempting to understand advanced skin cancers. So I'd like to begin by speaking about the importance of creating a support network when you're diagnosed with cancer or caring for someone with cancer. And there are many ways cancer care can be part of your network, and there are many ways that the social workers here can help. So here we are a national nonprofit organization, and we provide free professional support services to anyone who's been affected by cancer. All of our services are provided by licensed master's level oncology social workers, and it is completely free of charge. So we are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and their friends. And we're also trained to help people with cancer and their families tackle the problems that accompany the disease, such as the financial demands, the physical changes, social adjustment, and psychological impact, and overall care. So adjusting to and dealing with the diagnosis is an important part of the healing process. And as social workers, we would argue that it is an essential part. Additionally, we provide education about resources and how to navigate the healthcare system, help you find practical help, discuss some limited financial assistance, such as how to apply for chemo copay assistance. We also help people develop questions to ask their doctors. One question that social workers often get is how to get ready and prepare for skin cancer treatment. And it's important to include mental preparation when you think about starting a treatment plan. Like the two other presenters were mentioning, talk to your doctor or nurse about what to expect. Bring up questions to them. Let them know if there are side effects. And whether you are a patient or a caregiver, cancer affects the whole person and the entire family. So having answers to these questions will affect you, even if you're not the one who's been diagnosed. So if you feel anxious or distressed and need support outside of your own network of family and friends, you can work with a hospital oncology social worker or a social worker here to address these concerns. Asking for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of strength, and I want to just reiterate that. It's a sign of doing something very brave and something very strong. You do not have to walk this path alone. And joining a support group is a way to connect with others who are going through something similar or having similar problems, whether that be they're a patient or they're a caregiver. And individual counseling provides a space that is just yours to voice any concerns. And these are the connections that help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer or caring for someone with cancer experience. Feeling well emotionally can help you better deal with the diagnosis and the treatment that's to come. And at this time, cancer care offers both online and telephone support groups. I also like to mention that we have a unique young adult program, which offers both patient and caregiver online support groups. And that's for people who are between the ages of 20 and 39 years old who are currently dealing with a diagnosis. And the online group support allows people from all over the world to write and share about their cancer experiences. It could be practical concerns, it could be tips, or just ventilating how it's been with the treatments. And if you're interested in any of our services, please call our Hope Line, and the number for that is 1-800-813-HOPE, or 4673 as the last four digits. Or if it's the online support group that interests you, then you can visit our website, which is www.cancercare.org. And there you can find where our support groups are online to create a login and a password. And then one of our social workers would send you some assessment questions. Please remember again that you are not alone. Cancer Care Services are there to help you. And I thank you for your attention and the opportunity to talk with you today.
Well, thank you very much, Ms. Eckhart. That was an outstanding presentation, very informative, and I hope people will take advantage of the services of Cancer Care if you haven't already. And now we have time for questions. We actually have a lot of time for questions. I'm going to ask Kate to explain to the audience how to queue up for questions. I'm going to try to take as many questions as possible.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. And again, ladies and gentlemen, if you do have a question at this time, please press star, then the number 1 key on your touch-tone telephone.
And we have a question from one of our online participants, the question, really excellent question, is I'd like to know how best to manage my basal cell cancer and to know if there are any preventives besides using SPF lotion. Dr. Akatura, would you address that?
Yes. In terms of preventing basal cell carcinoma, I think that the only strategy that has been proven so far is by decreasing the amount of sun exposure. There are some individuals that are at higher risk of basal cell carcinoma. These include people that are born with a condition known as basal cell nevus syndrome, or a syndrome that one inherits from their parents that renders them at higher risk for developing many basal cell carcinomas. These people will develop basal cell carcinomas even as children, and also they may develop hundreds over their lifetime. This syndrome is associated with other conditions that include certain growths in the jaw and other abnormalities in the bones. In addition to this, people who have received radiation as part of cancer treatment or as part of, in the past, radiation was used for the treatment of acne and other skin conditions, over several decades after this radiation, people are also at higher risk for developing basal cell cancers in those areas. So those are people that would be at higher risk, but other than using some protective measures that we have discussed, there are no other ways to prevent basal cell carcinomas. Unless one of my colleagues has anything to add to this, that would be my response.
Okay. Thank you. Dr. Ho, did you want to add anything to that? Or?
Well, I think in terms of the question about how to manage the basal cell carcinoma, you can't emphasize enough that every patient's case is individualized, and particularly if it's a basal cell carcinoma that's atypical of, you know, 90% of what is seen in the dermatologist's office, this often does require the opinions of your doctors and of different disciplines. So it's hard to address that question specifically, but what I would say is, you know, that has to be something that you discuss specifically with your own physician.
Awesome. Thank you. And then
I agree with that there are many different ways of treating basal cell carcinoma, and that will depend largely on the location of the basal cell carcinoma in the body. That will depend on how on the appearance of that basal cell carcinoma under the microscope after a biopsy has been done, and whether the area where the basal cell carcinoma occurred previously had been treated for a similar occurrence of basal cell carcinoma. So it is, I agree with Dr. Hull that it is something that one needs to go to the doctor in person in order to obtain a responsible answer.
Excellent. Thank you. And another question from one of our online participants is, what should I do to be ready for treatment? Dr. Ho, can you address that? And Dr. Lacatore may want to add to that as well, but how does one prepare for treatment for basal cell or squamous cell cancers?
I'm sorry. I can start. And so, you know, I think when you're thinking about drug therapy or systemic therapy, I think the preparation really is specific to the drug that you're being prescribed. But generally speaking, I think it's being educated about the potential side effects that can occur. I think all of the things that we've discussed are some of the most common side effects and toxicities that are associated with these drugs. The truth of the matter is generally, in terms of the severity and the occurrence of these things, can be very heterogeneous among patients. And so part of that is being educated about what could happen and being prepared and having that support network around you to help you deal with those things. In some instances, you know, preventative medications can be useful. This is, you know, an area that Dr. Lacatore has pioneered for the use of many of these newer agents. But again, those are going to be specific instances with specific drugs. And so what I always tell patients is that knowing up front, if we're using systemic treatment to try to control the disease, the other side of that is being very cognizant of how you're feeling on the therapy. The goal of any kind of chemotherapy in that setting is not to torture patients, is not to give them therapies that they can't live with. And so it's going to be a process where we're trying to mitigate your side effects either by providing new treatments for the side effects that occur or even modifying the dose and schedule of the chemotherapy that you're getting.
Well, thank you. Excellent. And Dr. Lacatore, did you want to add anything? Or?
Yes, I agree with Dr. Ho again. I think that it will be very dependent on what type of therapy is started, and each different kind of drug has its own set of side effects. Importantly, however, with some of these medications, there are side effects that we are able to prevent. For example, with the taxanes, we are able to prevent the nail changes, the painful nails that may occur in about a third to half of people receiving these drugs. With cetuximab or Erbitux, we are able to prevent the acne-like rash and dry skin, as well as painful nail inflammation that occurs with the use of topical medications and oral antibiotics. And then with fluorouracil and bismodegib, because the side effects, at least the skin side effects, are so inconsistent, what we usually do is we inform people to use the sensible sun protective measures, and at the first sign of a side effect, that they call our office and inform us, because the earlier a side effect is treated, the better the outcome will be in terms of resolving or mitigating that side effect. So it is very important for people to report to their oncologist at the first sign that they are developing a side effect, and not to wait till the next appointment, or if it is an oral medication, a tablet, for example, not to stop taking it on their own and just waiting for the next appointment. I am very confident to say that oncologists care so much about their patients that they would like to hear about any side effect that they are having even before their next appointment is scheduled.
That's such an important point. I hope everybody heard that indeed you actually can call, you know, between appointments. Do you want to say a bit about that? Sometimes people think they have to wait till the next appointment. Do you want to comment again, Dr. Lector, about that, that to call when there's a problem?
Correct. Well, and in many instances, depending on your location, your doctor may give you their number, which you can call and discuss with the nurse. Some doctors, depending on the state and the certain regulations, may also give you their email, so you can contact them via that method. But it is important not to wait for the next appointment and not to feel that a side effect will, in most cases, result in discontinuation or stopping your therapy. In fact, if most side effects that we see, when they are reported early on, people can continue with their therapy.
Excellent. Thank you. And Dr. Ho, did you want to comment as well again?
Well, I was just going to reiterate what Dr. Lakator said. I think, particularly in situations where you've developed a new side effect or something that hasn't been anticipated, it is critical to know as early as possible so that those early interventions can begin. I think it's also important that patients know that this is, you shouldn't feel alone in between appointments. This is not a situation where, your interactions with your medical team is limited just to the times that you're scheduled to see them, because, in fact, this is a continuous process. And particularly when you're beginning chemotherapy, that first month, I always tell my patients, is a critical time for us just to figure out how you react with the drug. And we always want to be as responsive as possible in terms of new other interventions that are required or modifying the dose of the medications that you're being given, and that can only really take place if the communication is two ways.
Excellent. And Ms. Eckert, do you want to comment just on the sometimes people, in terms of preparing for starting treatment, may want to access some psychosocial support services, call one of our staff here or join a support group. Could you comment on that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, what we were just talking about calling the doctor in between appointments, I have to say that is something that I think it's like the number one question I get on our Hope Line. People wondering about their side effects, not wanting to bother the doctor, feeling like, oh, I can wait. And I just love that this came up in this discussion because it is something that comes up over and over and over again. And we do provide, you know, some support, but there's nothing better than hearing it directly from doctors that it is okay to call, and in fact that there is things that can be done that can to prevent the continuation of the side effects or just getting, you know, stuff addressed early on. People's questions are important, and knowing that they have the ability to call and connect, and that it's okay and it's wanted, it's appreciated, and it's essential for their treatment. Definitely this is something that comes across the calls, and it's what we're here for.
Excellent. Thank you. So there is a consistency here for everybody to hear that indeed you can call your doctor's office when you have a symptom or any concern that you have. That really, they're often very eager and they're very able to help you with it. That's the most important thing as well. So These are really excellent questions. We have another question from one of our online participants regarding really sun exposure again. So the question is, what should I take special precautions to avoid sun exposure? What are the most important steps I can take to protect myself from the sun? Dr. LaCouture, could you address that?
Yes. The most important steps you can take to protect yourself from the sun are to avoid going outside unprotected between the hours of 10 a.m. and 4 p.m. But please note what I mean is unprotected. It is not our goal as physicians or your oncologist's goal to make you stay at home during the daytime and not do the activities you enjoy doing with your friends, family, or going to work. You can go out any time of the day you want, even if it is sunny. But use protection. By protection, we mean using a broad-brimmed hat, using sunglasses that protect you against ultraviolet radiation, applying sunscreen to exposed areas of the body every 2 hours or every hour if swimming or sweating. Your sunscreen should have an SPF or sun protection factor of at least 30, and make sure that you apply enough of your sunscreen. Your sunscreen should be what we call broad spectrum, or in other words, protects against all types of radiation that can cause skin cancer coming from the sun, and you would be able to identify this in the back of the label in the tube or in the bottle. Importantly, apply enough sunscreen to your entire body. By that I mean that you need to apply about 1 ounce or an amount the size of a golf ball when you apply to your body each and every single time every 2 hours. Additionally, using sun-protected clothing would also be of advantage. For example, it is important if you are going out between the hours of 10 a.m. and 4 p.m. to use long sleeve shirts or long pants if you will be out in the sun. There are a number of brands out there that have integrated sun-protected molecules into the fabric of the clothing, and you can obtain these online. In addition to that, if you do not like these products, what you can do is there are certain laundry detergents that you can add to the washing machine when you wash your clothes that will render your clothes sun-protected, and you can also obtain these online. This summarizes the main sun-protective measures we recommend to patients as dermatologists.
You know, we haven't talked about the laundry detergents before. Could you just say a little bit more about those, Dr. LaCouture? I don't think that's come up before on the calls.
Yes. There is a product called SunGuard Sun Protection that can be obtained online or in certain stores. I recommend you look online as to see which store has it. And this product, you add it to your laundry, to the laundry when you are washing it, and it lasts for up to 10 washes after you apply it. Interestingly, this product is integrated into the fabric of your clothing when you apply it into the washing machine, and you can use it is not noticeable, and it will not allow the penetration of damaging radiation from the sun into your skin when you have your clothes on. Keep in mind that just wearing a regular white T-shirt, for example, will not allow enough sun protection, especially if if you are wearing clothing that is not tight woven, that is light in color, or clothing that is wet. So keep in mind that sun protective clothing could be another potential strategy for minimizing the amount of UV rays that you receive in your skin.
That's excellent. Thank you. That's very helpful. And I don't know if everyone knew that, but that's wonderful information for everyone to have. Another question is, are any of my family members at risk for skin cancer? If I have skin cancer, what should I tell them to do? Dr. Ho, could you address that?
Well, I think we can generally say that there are certain patients where they have to deal with multiple type of skin cancers that need to be dealt kind of on a regular basis as they grow older. We often do wonder about their predisposition to having these cancers. I think oftentimes when it comes to squamous cell cancers, these are patients often that are fair-skinned and had heavy sun exposure when they were younger. And I think generally speaking, it's safe to assume that lifetime exposure and early times exposure to the sun can increase your risk of these diseases. And I think the one and number one, you know, intervention for that is really prevention with all of the sun protective interventions that Dr. Lakator has been speaking about. In terms of genetic syndromes, those kinds of cancers are quite rare. Known genetic syndromes, and then often those instances, the skin cancers occur at an earlier age, are much more aggressive, and occur in greater numbers. This basal cell nevus syndrome that Dr. Lakator had mentioned before, those kinds of patients have basal cell cancers in the hundreds or even thousands. So those are very rare and unique type of situations. So I think if you have a relative or yourself have difficulty with skin cancers or with multiple recurrent disease, I think the only, you know, prudent kind of approach is just encouraging protection against sun damage.
I want to thank all of our speakers. You've really been extraordinary. This has been an amazing call, covering a lot of information. I hope this has been helpful to all of you. I want to thank our speakers. I want to thank all of you who have queued up and really asked such wonderful questions online. And I also want to thank all of you who have been listening. I do want to remind everyone this is a one-hour program and that it is part of a three-part series. And so there are two more workshops coming up. One is going to be on May 9th on metastatic melanoma, and a part three is on May 23rd on the role of immuno-oncology in treating melanoma. And so there's more to come in terms of programming. Also, I do want to reiterate much of what Ms. Eckhart had said, that we do have a staff here of oncology social workers. We're here to help you with your questions and concerns. You know, this is a one-hour program, and many of you have questions that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour, both questions, practical needs, perhaps needs for financial assistance, for getting appropriate care for yourself, of getting wanting some counseling service or wanting to join a support group, or maybe just being worried about something and be helpful to talk with someone about that. All of those services are accessible on our telephone. We can call 1-800-813-HOPE, our HOPE line, and we're here to help you. And most importantly, I wouldn't want anyone to leave today's call feeling you're alone, because we do have this extensive staff of oncology social workers here at Cancer Care who are here to really help answer your questions and help to guide you and to offer support to you. So most importantly, as we conclude today, I don't want anyone to think they're alone. I want you to know that you can call us. And you also have heard that if you have a question, a medical question, that your physicians also are eager to have your questions asked of them as well. And I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may disconnect. Have a wonderful day.